Hey, you podcast listener, we've got a new episode coming up, but before we get started, I want to take a moment to talk to you about supporting our show and your local public radio station. So, you know what we do here at Latino USA. It's all about our commitment to great journalism. And because of that, you trust us because you know that we're going to report on the stories that matter most to the Latino community in the United States. You know there are so many unforgettable examples of great reporting on Latino USA, whether it was the story of the Quevedos, finding a family that you didn't know you actually needed, or the moral dilemma of Juan Sanchez, who runs many of the shelters where the migrant children are being held, or our story about Frida Kahlo and Barbie. Who would think about doing that except for Latino USA? I know. I just made you remember why you love Latino USA. It's because of this high-quality journalism and the fact that we tell stories that no one else is telling. So, as you know, we are funded by our listeners. And right now, we're approaching the end of the year, which is a great time for you, the listener, to contribute. What you can do is make an end-of-the-year gift to your NPR station now, and you'll also be supporting Latino USA. Visit donate.npr.org/LatinoUSA. And gracias. Thank you so much. From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, we bring you a couple of stories from our friends at The Moth. Since its launch in 1997, The Moth has presented thousands of stories told live and without notes by everyday people. And we're partnering with The Moth to feature some of their best Latino storytellers on our show. First up, a story from Carlos Kotkin about the birth of his first child, who came sooner than expected.
About a year into our marriage, my wife and I decided we were ready for the adventure of having a child. So we officially started trying, as they say. And 8 months later, bingo, my wife got pregnant. I was very excited about the idea of becoming a father. I had been well-trained. My dad is the best dad I could possibly ask for. If I did half the job my dad did, I would be in good shape. There's only one time where my dad's parenting skills were questionable. When I was 12, we went on a hike, and on the side of the trail, we discovered a standing hollow tree stump about my height. My dad looked at it, he looked at me, and he said, "Why don't you see if you can fit in there?" So I climbed inside, up to my armpits. I was like a cork in a wine bottle, and I looked at my dad, and I said, "I do fit in here." So then we were going to continue with the hike, but I couldn't get out. No matter how hard I tried, I could not get out. And my dad couldn't get me out, no matter how hard he tried. Eventually, he had to take off and go find some forest rangers. It was terrible, terrible, terrible. So that's the only negative experience I associate with my father. Although even that is a positive because I learned not to ask my future kid to climb into a hollow tree stump. So I was very excited about the idea of becoming someone's dad, about being someone's tour guide on their journey through life. The first time we heard the baby's heartbeat was the first time we went to the obstetrician. It was very fast and very loud. I can hear it right now. I asked the doctor when the baby's due date was. She took out her phone and used an app to calculate, and she told us that the baby would arrive October 12th. And from that moment on, October 12th became a date that loomed large. It was kind of like when they show a hurricane on the news, on the weather map, getting bigger and bigger. Only in my case, it was my wife's belly getting bigger and bigger. By the time she looked like she had a basketball under her shirt, the baby was moving around a lot, but I kept missing it. It was so disappointing. I wanted to feel it. And one night when the baby was particularly active, my wife called me over. Come here. Put your hand. You'll feel it. She took my hand. She put it on her belly. And I waited and waited for something to happen. Nothing. Finally, I commented, "This is kind of like whale watching." And something in the tone of my wife's voice when she said, "Gee, thanks," signaled to me that perhaps I should have phrased things a little differently. I didn't know what I was doing. It was a new experience for me, for my wife too. My wife didn't want to know anything. As far as she was concerned, the less she knew about being pregnant, the better. She was scared. And I was the opposite. I wanted to know everything. I wanted to understand what she was going through. So I did a lot of reading on pregnancy websites. And every now and then, my wife would let me know about something unusual that was happening with her body, and I would be able to tell her, "That's not unusual. It's perfectly normal. It's all over the mommy message boards. Don't worry about it." We got a little more insight when we had dinner with our friends, Mark and Ann, who have three kids. Mark was very upset when he found out I did not have a birth plan. He said, "You have to have a birth plan. You need to know where to park. Is she going to get an epidural? Is there going to be a shaman in the room? You need to know these things." He was so upset. I told him to calm down. I promised him I would get a birth plan. A few days after that dinner, my wife and I, we were driving home, and we passed the hospital about a mile from where we live. And I casually pointed out to her, I said, that's where we're going to be. We're going to be in one of those delivery rooms. That's where we're going to meet our kid." And my wife responded, "I don't want you in the room." This was a big surprise to me. I thought for sure I was going to be in the room. I wanted to be in the room. As far as I was concerned, being in the room was like greeting a relative when they arrive at the airport. "You're here, hooray." But my wife told me that she did, this was her challenge. She was going to do it on her own. When we got home, we talked about it some more. I asked her if she was sure, because I could hold her hand. I could cheer her on. I could say things like, "You're doing great, honey. Keep up the good work." But she was adamant that this was her challenge to face on her own. I was dismayed. I didn't understand it, but I didn't put up a fight, because from everything I had read about delivering a child, it sounded uncomfortable. And I didn't, I didn't want to make her more uncomfortable than she was already going to be by my presence. So I accepted it. It was hard to accept it, but I accepted it. And there's a small park on the grounds of the hospital. And I decided that the day that our child arrived, I would sit in that park on a bench. Maybe I would have a snack. And at some point I would receive a text saying, "Come meet your baby, smiley face." And that would be how I experienced labor and delivery. And I pictured myself sitting on that bench on October 12th many, many times. However, on August 12th, 2 months, exactly 2 months before October 12th, my wife woke me up around 10:30 at night, and with concern, she told me, "Something is happening." Her water broke. I hopped out of bed and immediately thought, "I need to get a birth plan." First step in my plan, put some pants on, which I did. We were ready to leave within minutes. There was just one obstacle in the living room we needed to get past: my in-laws. They just happened to be visiting and were sleeping on an air mattress. And I looked at my wife. I said, "What do you want to do about the people in the other room?" And she whispered urgently, "Just go." So we just went. I didn't look at them. I raced past them. I didn't know if they were awake. We get to the car, and I receive a text from my mother-in-law, "Where are you going?" I didn't know whether to tell her the truth and freak her out, or play it cool and respond something along the lines of, "Everything's fine, we're just going to a rave." Don't worry about it. I decided that I would let her know what was happening when I knew what was happening. So we got to the hospital in record time. We rushed to the security guard and asked him, where do people go when they have babies? These were his exact words. Make a left, take the elevator to the second floor, make a right and a right and a right. Go down the hall, make a right and a left and another right, and then ring the doorbell. And somehow we did that. So my wife got admitted, and a nurse examined her, and the nurse told us that the baby wanted to arrive, but they would be able to delay the arrival by about a month. My wife was going to have to stay in the hospital on bed rest. They wheeled in a cot for me. I lied down in it, and next thing I knew, my wife's contractions began. And all of a sudden, my cot is being wheeled out, and a pit crew of people are racing in, including two nurses carrying a dessert tray. The on-call doctor also rushed in, examines my wife, and declares, "The baby is coming. Do you have any questions?" I asked the doctor if there was anything that we could give my wife because she was in so much pain. And the doctor said, "Unfortunately, there's no time." I so wanted to ask, "Is there anything you could give me? Because this is a really stressful environment." I was supposed to be in the park under a tree. Suddenly I'm in the trenches. I had a second to turn to my wife and ask her if she wanted me to leave. She reached up, grabbed my hand, and crushed the bones in it. I took that as a no, so I stayed right by her side. There was a washcloth on top of her head that somebody had placed there for some reason. And every time my wife pushed, the washcloth would slide off her face and cover her eyes. And so I picked it up, and I wanted to ask somebody if there was anywhere else we could put this, but everybody seemed busy, so I carefully put it back on top of my wife's head and waited for it to fall. And then I would put it back on her head. And that's what I did for most of the time, was I would just... Okay. Besides the washcloth, there was more squeezing and breathing and counting and pushing. And then there was our baby, smallest, tiniest human being I had ever seen, crying so loudly. And the doctor yelled out right away, "That crying is fantastic." And they took they put the baby on the dessert tray, and they carried the dessert tray and the baby to the neonatal intensive care unit, the NICU, a place I never realized existed until I walked into one. It's a place where professional guardian angels keep premature babies warm and safe and alive. There were five other premature babies. You could see them in their pods, and none of them looked like newborns. All of them looked like they still belonged in the womb, which they did. They definitely needed help, and they were getting it. When my wife and I gazed at our child from both sides of the incubator, I looked at the baby and I said to the baby, "We're your parents." And the baby smiled. It was probably gas, but it was a genuine smile at the absolute perfect moment. I called the in-laws later that morning and told them the news. As I waited for them to arrive at the hospital, I saw a group of pregnant women with their husbands taking a tour. They were so giddy and chatty, as if they were on a field trip. I looked at them and I couldn't help but think, what a bunch of amateurs. So our child stayed in the NICU for 5 weeks, and then we brought the baby home healthy. several months into parenthood, as we carried the baby into the bedroom and put the baby in the crib, as we walked out, I whispered to my wife, "Isn't it amazing that we made a person?" My wife looked at me with hesitance. She asked me, "Do you look at me differently now that you've seen me deliver a baby?" And in that moment, I realized why she didn't want me in the room. I'm slow, but eventually I get things. And I felt very bad that she had the concern I would be less attracted to her. So I took her in my arms, and right away I told her, "Of course I look at you differently. I'm in awe of you. You nourished and nurtured and sheltered a life with your body, and then you brought that life into the world. I did one thing, and it wasn't that difficult." My wife is a superhero. I love her and our 16-month-old daughter more than words can express. Thank you.
Carlos Kotkin.
Carlos Kotkin is a comedy writer and storyteller. Coming up, Pilar Simán tells us about spending time with a crush in an unlikely place. That would be 11 p.m. Mass. Stay with us. No te vayas.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from BetterHelp. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors who specialize in issues such as depression, stress, anxiety, and more. Connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment at your convenience. Get help at your own time and your own pace. Schedule secure video or phone sessions. Plus, chat and text with your therapist. Visit BetterHelp.com/NPR to learn more and get 10% off your first month.
Whether it's athlete protests, the Muslim travel ban, gun violence, school reform, or just the music that's giving you life right now, race is the subtext to so much of the American story. And on Code Switch, we make that subtext text. You can listen to us on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, we're back. And next up, we're going to hear another story from The Moth from storyteller Pilar Simán, who spent a lot of time going to Mass because of a crush.
So it was my freshman year at college, and I fell in love with the back of his head first. We were in a government class, and he had this blonde hair, and he was just so smart. He was an ROTC, so he was very fit. And so I start falling for him, and I'm like, this guy's cute. I want to figure out a way to talk to him. So one day we start talking, and we find out we're both Catholic. We both go to Mass, and he says, you know, you should really check out the 11 p.m. Mass. It's very solemn, very quiet. You know, you can really get your thoughts together. And I am not a solemn or quiet person, so that is the opposite of any kind of Mass I would go to. I go to the really loud, cheesy one where everyone claps. And I said, yeah, that's exactly what I like. So I start going to 11 p.m. solemn Mass, you know, just so I can see him. And we talk after Mass, and I'm thinking he's falling in love with me. You know, we have these moments. We go to Mass together. This is such a spiritual connection. So I'm basically thinking, I tell my roommate, like, you know, we're dating. So then a few months into it, he says, I'm going to be leading a retreat. Do you want to lead with me? And I'm thinking, like, we're engaged. You know, obviously. Like, he's like, you know, it might take a lot of time. We're going to have to meet every week. And I'm like, this is a serious relationship. You know, I know he's shy. He doesn't want to say it. But, you know, we're obviously on the same page. So we meet every week and we plan and, you know, in the dorm room. And so after a few weeks of this, I tell my roommate, I'm like, this is the night. Like, you know, I'm clearly getting the vibe. He really likes me. I really like him. I think I'm just going to tell him. I'm going to tell him I like him because it's just too awkward. There's too much tension. You know, we're always going to each other's dorm rooms. Like, something's got to happen. So I get to his dorm room. We're working on stuff. And he says to me, I have something I want to say to you. And I'm thinking, like, this is it. Like, this is what I've been waiting for. We are so on the same page. And I said, me too. I said, but you go first. Thank God I said you go first. So I'm like getting like really nervous and emotional. I'm like, oh God, this is it. This is it. Like, I knew it. And he says, this is not easy for me to say. And I'm like, of course not. Like, how would it be? And he's like, but I've known for a while. And I'm like, me too. And he's like, I've been praying about it. And I'm like, well, maybe. Yeah, I've been praying about it. And he says, I'm going to be a priest. Like, never. I had played out this scenario so many times with my roommate, with my friends. We had talked about it. Like, what could he say? What could I say? Never did I ever imagine he would say, no, he actually said, I feel called to be a priest. So you can't be like that bitch, that other girl, you know? You can't be like, why have you been leading me on? You can't say any of that. I was like, you know, I feel cheated on. Like, all those nights in mass. Like, I thought, like, we were in mass. I was thinking of him. He's thinking of me. No, he's, like, thinking of God. Like, how he should be in mass, right? So then he turns to me and he says, what is it that you wanted to say? And I'm just like, thank God. Thank God I did not go first. Thank God I did not go first. And I just said, no, I just wanted to say that it's been really great working with you. I said, I'm you know, I'm really happy for you. Not really happy for you, but at the same time, I can't be like mad. So I said, you know, how long have you known? And he's like, you know, for this whole year, really, all those times I was in mass, I was really thinking about it. So I'm like, okay, all right. All right, fast forward 5 years later. I graduate. I decide to do a volunteer program in South America. I'm working in a very rural village, and I get this email from this guy who also had gone to a Jesuit Catholic university who says, you know, I want to meet other Americans. Can I come and meet you and the other volunteer? And I'm like, sure, come over, meet us. So he comes over. We spend the day together, and I am in love. I am like, oh, my God, this is it. This is the one. But then I start thinking, he's a good person. He wants to help the poor. He's smart. I'm like, he's going to be a Jesuit. Like the other one. I'm like, for sure. And I'm like, I'm not going to do this again. So I said to him, I know we've only known each other for like an hour, but I said, have you ever considered becoming a Jesuit, which is a type of priest? And he says, that's actually what I'm doing here in South America. I'm trying to figure out if that's my calling. So the good news for me and our future baby is that that was not his calling.
That story was from Pilar Simán. Our thanks to our friends at The Moth for the stories we heard today. The Latino USA team includes Marlon Bishop, Miguel Macias, Sofia Paliza-Ca, Antonia Cerejido, Maggie Freeling, Janice Yamoga, Sayer Quevedo, and Maya Cueva, with help from Fernanda Chavarri. Our engineer is Stephanie LeBeau. Additional engineering this week by Rebecca Weinman. Our production manager is Natalia Fidelholz. Our fellow is Jesse Alejandro Cottrell. Our interns are Paula Mora and Comis Johnson. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. And if you like the music you heard on this episode, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. Oh, and one more thing. Can you go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review Latino USA? Because it really helps new listeners to find us. And we love to read your comments. So keep them coming. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on our next episode. And in the meantime, look for us on all of your social media. I'll see you there. Ciao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the New York Women's Foundation, funding women leaders that build solutions in their communities and celebrating 30 years of radical generosity. The Annie E. Casey Foundation creates a brighter future for the nation's children by strengthening families, building greater economic opportunity, and transforming communities. And the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Hey, it's me again, and I hope you enjoyed the show today. I know I did. And this is just a reminder to please take just a little minute from your day to make this show possible by contributing. Support Latino USA and your local public radio station by donating today. Visit donate.npr.org/Latino USA. Gracias. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, foster care. It's a part of American society, but is it just another form of family separation that's much more pervasive? A look into the journey of one woman trying to take back her children from the child welfare system. That's next time on Latino USA.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We do long-form interviews with the people behind the best books, pop culture, journalism, and more, so you can get to know the people whose work you love. You'll find Fresh Air on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.